to Aviation Intelligence Weekly with Sarah and Mike, your guide to the aviation industry. Jet fuel just hit $8.31 a gallon, up nearly $2 from this time last year, and the industry's profit forecast just got cut in half. That's the week in one sentence.
And the market is not treating every airline the same, not even close. We've got carriers raising guidance, while others are pulling it entirely, and the eVTOL space just made one of the most significant structural moves we've seen in years. A lot to unpack.
We'll get to the price action, the filings, and the big strategic reshaping happening in autonomous aviation. But let's start with the macro spine, because this week didn't happen in isolation.
Nothing in aviation does right now. Every number you look at traces back to the same pressure point.
The narrative this week was fuel-driven margin compression, forcing a visible, accelerating separation between carriers that have the balance sheet and network to absorb the shock and those that don't. That's the story, not just high fuel, the consequences of high fuel hitting an industry with uneven financial resilience.
And the Hormuz disruption is the mechanism. The ceasefire with Iran effectively broke down, shipping lanes are disrupted, and Jet A followed crude higher by 70 cents just in August. Year over year, that's up about 20% at the pump level for airlines.
Operationally, what this means is that airlines running older, less fuel-efficient fleets, because Boeing and Airbus haven't been able to deliver new jets fast enough, are getting hit from two directions simultaneously: higher fuel burn per seat mile and higher maintenance costs on aging airframes.
That's a brutal combination. You can't hedge your way out of an older fleet.
For investors, the implication is that this isn't a uniform sector risk. It's a sorting mechanism. The carriers with strong premium revenue, international network pricing power, and hedging programs are holding guidance. The ones without those buffers are either cutting guidance or withdrawing it entirely. That divergence is where the trade is.
And IATA put a number on it this week that really crystallized things. Global airline profits, they're now projecting, will fall from $45 billion in 2025 to roughly $23 billion in 2026. That's nearly a 50% reduction in industry profitability in 1 year.
Which is the kind of figure that reframes everything else you see in the price action. When you see certain carriers holding up and others selling off hard, that's not random. That's the market pricing in who survives that profit haircut and who doesn't.
So let's name the primary signal clearly. The most important signal this week came from the airline earnings and guidance revisions taken together as a sector. The divergence between carriers that raised or held full-year EPS guidance and carriers that cut or withdrew it entirely in the same fuel environment, in the same demand environment.
That's the signal, and it's sector level, not a single company story. Delta posted nearly $20 billion in quarterly revenue. United raised its full-year EPS guidance to a range of $9 to $11. On the other side, American's full-year range is now anywhere from a 65-cent adjusted loss to a 65-cent profit. That's a spread of $1.30, which tells you they have almost no visibility into their own results.
And Southwest and Alaska both cut or withdrew guidance. Same week, same fuel price. Different outcomes based almost entirely on network structure and balance sheet position.
Operationally, what this signal means is that carriers with large international networks, premium cabin revenue, and corporate travel exposure have structural pricing power that lets them pass fuel costs through to the passenger. Carriers with predominantly domestic leisure routes, thin margins, and limited hedging cannot do the same.
For investors, this confirms that the sector allocation question right now isn't airlines versus something else. It's which tier of airline you own, because the dispersion in outcomes is wide enough to matter enormously for returns.
That's the primary signal. Everything else we look at today either reinforces it or adds texture to it. Let's get into the price action and see how the market actually scored the week.
All right, TSA checkpoint data first, because it sets the demand baseline. This week, TSA screened 12.8 million passengers, up 0.5% year over year, and essentially flat against the 3-year average. No significant drop-off, no surge either.
So demand isn't the problem. 12.8 million travelers through security in a week. That's a healthy number. The issue isn't that people stopped flying.
Right. The issue is what it costs to put them in seats. And then what's left over after you pay for the fuel to get them there. Let's look at what the market did with that setup. Major airlines were under real pressure at the start of the week. United gave back nearly 4.5% in a single session on Monday before recovering.
And the low-cost carriers had a rough week overall. Allegiant dropped more than 4% for the week, including a single-day move of over 6% on Monday. That's the market repricing fuel exposure in real time.
Alaska was down nearly 3% for the week, and Southwest finished down about 1.5%. The common pressure evident in the available data was fuel, and the resulting guidance pressure. The guidance cuts landed in the same news cycle as the fuel figures, and the market repriced both together.
Now flip to the other side of the ledger. Aerostructures and components. Hexcel, Howmet, both up on the week, roughly 2 to 3%. HEICO up almost 3%. Those names don't have jet fuel exposure. They have backlog exposure, and backlog is fine.
MRO was the big winner, and we need to spend a minute on it. VSE Corporation had an extraordinary week, up over 9%, essentially all of it in a single session on Tuesday. That's the kind of move that tells you something specific happened.
The data doesn't confirm a single disclosed catalyst this week beyond strong sector sentiment around MRO demand. But the context is clear. When airlines are forced to maintain aging fleets rather than replace them with new deliveries, the MRO business benefits structurally. VSE is well positioned in that environment.
What matters here is not just that VSE moved, it's what the move tells you about where money is rotating within aviation, away from carriers facing margin pressure toward the infrastructure that keeps the old planes flying.
That rotation is meaningful. Defense primes had a quiet but positive week. Most of the names in that group gained less than 2%, steady and unglamorous. The Pentagon contract flow continued, including a modification to the KC-46 training program and new multi-year framework agreements with defense primes totaling more than $3 billion for missile defense components.
Cargo was interesting. FedEx up nearly 3% for the week, which stands out against the flat week for its main competitor in that space. And the IATA data underlying that move is real. Global air cargo volumes were up 8.5% year over year in June, even as passenger demand contracted 1.7%.
That's a genuine divergence worth flagging. The cargo story and the passenger story are running in opposite directions right now, and carriers with meaningful belly cargo or dedicated freighter operations have a profit buffer that pure passenger operators don't.
In the eVTOL space, and we're going to get into this in detail in a moment, one name was up nearly 6% for the week, while another was down 10%. That split tells the whole story about where the market thinks value is being created versus diluted right now.
And on the OEM side, Boeing was essentially flat, down less than 0.5% for the week, which is interesting given the delivery data. Airbus is ahead 418 to 367 cumulative through July. Boeing delivered 13 Dreamliners in June, which signals some easing of production constraints, but they're still trying to get back into the 60s on monthly deliveries.
The market has already priced in the Boeing recovery narrative being slow. A flat week on mixed OEM data is actually consistent with that.
The real story behind these numbers, and this is the W4 transition, isn't the individual price moves. It's that the market is actively sorting aviation into two buckets: fuel-exposed, margin-compressed operators on one side, and infrastructure, MRO, defense, and cargo-exposed names on the other. And the spread between those two buckets widened materially this week.
That's where the market differentiation is becoming clearest. And it connects directly back to the primary signal. The guidance divergence isn't just an airline story, it's a capital flows story. Money is moving within aviation, not out of it.
Now let's talk about the filing activity this week, because there were two discrete signals worth pulling apart, and they point in very different directions. The first one is Southwest Airlines, and the reason it matters isn't the board appointments in isolation. It's the combination of moves Southwest made in a single week that tells you something structural is happening at that company.
Walk me through it, because on the surface, the Southwest filings look like routine corporate housekeeping. New directors, credit facility refinancing, neither of those individually is a headline.
Right. And that's exactly why you have to look at them together. On August 10th, Southwest files an 8K announcing two new board members, Varun Krishna, who runs Rocket Companies, and Jason Liberty, who is the chair and CEO of Royal Caribbean. Those are not aviation people.
That's an understatement. Royal Caribbean and a fintech mortgage company. You're not exactly pulling from the airline bench there.
And that's the point. You bring in a hospitality and loyalty ecosystem expert and a consumer finance and digital platform executive when you're rethinking how you monetize your customer base, not when you're optimizing hub schedules. This is a signal about where Southwest thinks its next layer of revenue has to come from.
Southwest Rapid Rewards program is genuinely one of the most valuable loyalty assets in domestic aviation. The question has always been whether they're extracting full value from it. And the honest answer has been no, compared to what Delta and United have built with their co-branded credit card programs.
Varun Krishna running Rocket Companies is directly relevant there. Rocket has built a sophisticated digital consumer acquisition and retention engine, and Southwest moving into deeper financial product integration, co-branded cards, point monetization, dynamic pricing of rewards. That's the strategic logic. Jason Liberty's Royal Caribbean connection brings the experiential premium angle. Southwest has always competed on simplicity and price. These appointments suggest they're trying to add a premium loyalty layer on top of that.
I'm not sure I'm entirely convinced the market reads it that way, though. Southwest was down 1.5% for the week, and the single-day move on the 10th, when the board announcement hit, was nearly negative 4.5%. If this is supposed to be a positive strategic signal, the market didn't treat it that way.
That's fair, and I'd push back slightly. The Monday sell-off was sector-wide. United was down 4.5% the same day. American was down nearly 6%. Alaska was down over 5%. The entire domestic airline complex sold off on Monday. Isolating Southwest's move as a reaction to the board news overstates the case.
Fair point. You can't pull Southwest's Monday number out of a day when every carrier was getting hit on the same fuel and guidance pressure.
Now, here's where the refinancing filing adds the second layer. 2 days later, Southwest files an 8K disclosing a new $2 billion five-year revolving credit facility with JP Morgan and Citibank as co-administrative agents. They simultaneously terminated the prior facility, which wasn't set to expire until August 2028.
So they're replacing a facility that had 2 years left to run. That's not routine. That's a deliberate financial repositioning.
The accordion feature is what I keep coming back to. The new facility has an uncommitted accordion that can expand it to $3 billion, subject to lender consent. Building in $1 billion of additional headroom is consistent with wanting that optionality available, whether to draw on it or simply to have the market know it exists.
And given the fuel environment, jet fuel at $8.31 a gallon, guidance cut or withdrawn, a carrier preemptively reinforcing its liquidity position is prudent. What the filing tells us is that the optionality is being put in place ahead of need. What it implies about management's internal expectations is not something the disclosure establishes.
Exactly. The combination of moves, board reconstitution toward consumer monetization expertise, and a preemptive liquidity reinforcement with expansion capacity is consistent with a company positioning for a different revenue architecture over the medium term, while its near-term margin story stays under pressure. That's a more interesting story than either filing alone.
The Form 4 from Krishna, coming in the next day, showing the standard equity grant, confirms he's in and compensated. Nothing unusual there. But the sequence of filings across 3 days tells a coherent strategic story if you read them together.
And the insider activity more broadly, the 6 additional Form 4 filings across 4 companies this week, none of them altered any thesis. Scheduled 10b5-1 sales, RSU grants, cashless option exercises. We screened them, nothing actionable.
All right, let's turn to the eVTOL filings, because that's the second supporting signal, and it is genuinely extraordinary. Not just for the eVTOL sector, but for how it repositions the autonomous aviation landscape at a structural level.
This is the one that had me rereading the 8K three times to make sure I understood the scope correctly. On August 9th, Archer Aviation signs a definitive equity purchase agreement to acquire three Boeing-owned companies simultaneously: Wisk Aero, which is Boeing's autonomous aviation subsidiary; SkyGrid, which handles digital airspace management and air traffic coordination; and In-Situ, which operates in unmanned aircraft systems and AI-integrated drone technologies.
Three separate Boeing subsidiaries, all in one all-stock transaction. Let's talk about the deal structure first, because it's unusual. Archer is paying with 19.75% of its outstanding Class A common stock at closing, plus two warrants totaling $200 million in strike value. Boeing is effectively becoming a significant Archer shareholder.
Which means Boeing retains upside exposure to the autonomous aviation thesis it's been funding for years through Wisk, without having to carry these assets on its balance sheet. From Boeing's perspective, this is a clean way to monetize a strategic bet that hasn't produced revenue on a timeline that fits their current operational priorities.
But from Archer's perspective, and this is where it gets complicated, you're issuing nearly 20% of your equity at a moment when your stock is at $6.62 a share after a 5.75% gain this week. That's not a position of strength for a dilutive acquisition.
And yet the market reacted positively. Archer was up nearly 12% in a single session on Monday when the news hit. So the market is voting that the strategic value of what they're acquiring outweighs the dilution cost.
The Wisk piece is the critical asset here. Wisk has been developing autonomous passenger aircraft, fully pilotless, not just assisted, for years with Boeing's backing and FAA engagement. SkyGrid adds the airspace management infrastructure. In-Situ adds UAS and AI capability. Together, those three assets give Archer a vertical integration story that no other eVTOL company can currently claim.
You go from being an aircraft developer to being an autonomous aviation platform company. You control the vehicle, the airspace coordination software, and unmanned systems capability. That's a fundamentally different value proposition to enterprise customers and to the Department of Defense.
And the DoD angle matters because In-Situ has defense contracts. This isn't purely commercial eVTOL anymore. Archer just acquired a pathway into defense procurement with this deal.
Now contrast that with Joby's week, because the divergence is stark. Joby files its own 8K disclosing a $500 million acquisition of Strix Holdings, which owns Resonant Sciences. The consideration is roughly 60% cash and 40% equity. And the stock price reaction was the exact opposite of Archer's. Joby fell 10.1% for the week, including a single day move of nearly 5.5% on the 12th.
The market is drawing a very clear distinction between what Archer bought and what Joby bought. Resonant Sciences is a propulsion technology company. Valuable, technically credible, but it's an incremental capability addition, not a platform transformation.
And Joby is spending $500 million in a capital-intensive phase when they're not yet generating revenue. The 60% cash component of that deal is a real balance sheet event. Archer's all-stock deal preserves cash. The structural comparison between those two approaches in this market environment is not flattering to Joby.
What this week established in eVTOL is that the market is now differentiating between companies that are acquiring toward platform scale and companies that are acquiring toward technical capability. Platform scale gets rewarded with a 12% single-day move. Technical capability acquisition in a cash-burning company gets punished with a 10% weekly loss.
And that distinction matters beyond eVTOL. It's the same logic driving the rotation we talked about in the broader market, towards structural positioning and away from near-term margin vulnerability. The Archer-Joby divergence is a microcosm of the larger sorting the market is doing across all of aviation this week. So let's pull the divergence thread directly, because this week gave us one of the cleaner, natural experiments you'll see in a sector, Same fuel price, same demand environment, same macro backdrop, and wildly different outcomes depending on where you sit in the aviation stack.
The number that keeps coming back to me is the spread between VSE Corporation up 9.3% and Joby Aviation down 10.1% in the same week. That's a 19-point spread within a single sector. You don't get that without a structural story underneath it.
And the question you have to ask is this cyclical positioning or structural differentiation? Because the answer changes everything about how you think about portfolio construction in aviation right now.
I'd argue it's both, and that's actually the more uncomfortable answer. The cyclical component is obvious. Fuel at $8.31 a gallon is punishing fuel-exposed operators and rewarding businesses that don't burn jet fuel. VSE fixes planes, they don't fly them. That's a cyclical rotation.
But the structural piece is harder to dismiss. The MRO tailwind isn't just about this fuel spike. It's about the fact that Boeing and Airbus combined cannot deliver new aircraft fast enough, which means airlines are flying older fleets longer, which means the addressable market for maintenance, repair, and overhaul expands structurally over a multi-year horizon. VSE's 9% week isn't just a fuel trade. It's the market pricing in a durable backlog story.
Same logic applies to the Archer-Joby divergence. Archer's 12% single-day move on the Boeing acquisition news isn't just sentiment. The market is repricing what Archer is as a company. Pre-deal, Archer was an eVTOL developer. Post-deal, if it closes, Archer controls autonomous aircraft development, airspace management software, and unmanned systems with defense contract exposure. That's a different asset class.
Which is why I keep coming back to the low-cost carrier sell-off as the cleanest cyclical signal of the week. Allegiant down 4.2%, Frontier down 1.3%, Alaska down 2.75%. Those moves are consistent with heightened fuel sensitivity. The business models haven't changed. The cost structure has.
And the recovery thesis for those names is straightforward if fuel comes back, which it might, if the Hormuz situation stabilizes. That's the cyclical case. Buy the beaten down domestic leisure carriers, wait for the geopolitical resolution, collect the rebound.
I'm more cautious on that trade than you are. The structural problem for the low-cost carriers isn't just this fuel spike. It's that they've been underinvesting in fleet renewal because the delivery queues are jammed, which means their fuel burn per seat mile is structurally higher than it should be. And that problem doesn't resolve when crude comes down.
That's a fair pushback. The fleet age issue is real, and it compounds the fuel exposure.
So the base case is that the divergence between infrastructure and MRO names versus fuel-exposed domestic operators continues through at least the first half of next year, but the key risk is a rapid Hormuz resolution that brings jet fuel back below $7 a gallon and triggers a sharp mean reversion trade in the beaten-down carrier names that catches the rotation completely off guard.
Which means the week ahead is going to be critical for a few of the data points that could either lock in this divergence or start unwinding it. Let me run through the four things I'm watching.
Go ahead.
Watch jet fuel spot price movement through the August 14th through 16th window, because it will confirm or contradict the thesis that the Hormuz disruption is durable rather than a short-term spike. And that answer is the single biggest input into whether the carrier guidance cuts represent a floor or a new ceiling.
Watch any follow-on SEC filings from Boeing or Archer related to the WISC, SkyGrid, and in-situ transaction structure, because it will confirm or contradict the market's reading that this deal genuinely transforms Archer into a platform company rather than just a larger aircraft developer with more diluted equity.
Watch American Airlines management commentary or any amended guidance disclosure, because it will confirm or contradict whether that $1.30 spread between a 65-cent loss and a 65-cent profit is starting to narrow in either direction. And that resolution tells you everything about the stress level in the balance, sheet challenge tier of domestic carriers.
And watch IATA or FAA regulatory language on eVTOL certification timelines following the Archer acquisition news. because it will confirm or contradict whether the addition of WISC's autonomous certification history actually accelerates Archer's path to commercial operations, or whether the regulatory complexity of consolidating three separate certification programs creates new friction instead of removing it. So let's close with the synthesis, because I think this week actually had more internal coherence than it might look like from the outside when you see a 10% loser and a 9% winner in the same sector.
The thread connecting all of it is capital allocation under constraint. Every major story this week, the IATA profit forecast cut, the Southwest board reconstitution and credit facility refinancing, the Archer acquisition, the MRO rotation was fundamentally about how aviation companies and aviation investors are repositioning capital when the easy environment is clearly over.
The fuel price is the constraint. The guidance divergence is the market's response to that constraint. And the M&A activity in eVTOL is what happens when companies realize that organic development alone isn't fast enough to reach scale before the capital window potentially closes.
The demand is still there. 12.8 million passengers through TSA this week says people are flying. The problem is entirely on the cost and capital side, and the companies that are moving decisively to restructure around that reality are the ones the market is rewarding.
This week, the signal was divergence driven by fuel cost dispersion, the action was platform building M&A in autonomous aviation, and the risk that neither confirms is a rapid geopolitical resolution that scrambles the entire rotation before it has time to play out.
That's the week, Aviation Intelligence Weekly. We'll be back next week with the filings, the price action, and whatever the market decides to do with the four watch items we just laid out.
Thanks for being with us.
This podcast is produced for informational purposes only and does not constitute investment advice. All data referenced in this episode was sourced from publicly available SEC filings, TSA checkpoint records, IATA publications, and market data current as of the week ending August 16th, 2026. Past performance of any security discussed is not indicative of future results. Aviation Intelligence Weekly and its hosts do not hold positions in any of the securities mentioned in this episode. Consult a qualified financial professional before making any investment decisions.
Welcome to Aviation Intelligence Weekly with Sarah and Mike, your guide to the aviation industry. Want the inside track on aviation's biggest players? Aviation Intelligence Weekly brings you expert analysis of airline earnings, breaking industry news, and deep dive company histories. From American Airlines to Boeing, we cover the business of flight every week. Subscribe now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen.